Welcome to the Food Junkies Recovery Story Podcast. Here we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of everyday people actively working on their recovery from food addiction. I hope to inspire you and increase your awareness about recovery from food addiction. Here we will talk about personal stories of recovery and the many ways to live in recovery. We will focus on the various solutions so that you can choose the best option for yourself. I want to encourage you to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make changes for yourself, tell others about your changes, and our message of hope will spread. Okay, guys, well, I'm super excited to welcome one of my recovery buddies, Joan Bjørnsgaard. Did I get it right, Joan? Did I say it correctly?
So close, Bjørnsgaard.
Bjørnsgaard. We never used last names, so I'm not sure she knows how to pronounce mine either. But anyways, I'm glad Joan's able to be with us today. And we're just going to go ahead and dive right in, Joan, and ask you if you could just start telling our audience about your personal story, how you got to where you are. You can jump in at any point where you want to start your recovery journey and how you got started on your recovery.
Well, I've been off sugar, flour, grains, all the processed food for 2 years now. So my journey of awareness and the whole thing starting really was in February 2 years ago. And what prompted it was I had a problem with hypertension all of a sudden and ended up in the hospital. And they said that I was like almost diabetic, that my A1C was so high. And I knew that both my brothers had diabetes and had heart attacks and strokes. And I'm 10 years older than they are, but I just, it was like, I've been into physical fitness all my life and been relatively healthy. And it was a real wake-up call. Of course, that didn't do it because that was in December. It scared me, but not enough. So the real seminal moment for me was it was Girl Scout cookie season. And someone at church was selling boxes, and I bought four boxes. My spouse bought four boxes, unknown to me. Well, I sat and ate all four boxes that I bought in a single setting. And it's like, this isn't okay. There's something going on here. And I started thinking about, you know, I remember going to parties where I would sit down next to the tray of chocolate-covered strawberries, and I would eat the entire tray at the party. And I would be so embarrassed that I did that. And it's like, why did I do that? And then I thought, and I went back further and further, and it's like, I can remember so many incidents of just binging out on any kind of sugar or sweet thing, like no control, no stopgap, no off switch. And in my past, I had been an eating disorder therapist when I started my career as a therapist. And everybody said, well, you don't have an eating disorder because you don't fit any of the categories. And I wasn't real heavy at the time. And it was like, okay, so this isn't an eating disorder because everybody's telling me it's not in my eating disorder community. And I went to a nutritionist for a while and she gave me the standard American diet, which was lots of sugar, but it was like just more carbs and processed foods. And none of this worked for me. So I knew it was something else and nobody could figure out what it was. So in February, after I ate that quadruple serving of Girl Scout cookies, and I mean all, they were all Thin Mints and Tagalongs, the peanut butter ones, I consumed all four boxes in a single setting. It was bad. And somehow I was reading online and got to Food Junkies, and I got to Dr. Vera Tarman's book. And I read the book, and all of a sudden the light went on. It never occurred to me that it was an addiction. I always just thought I was weak-willed or there was something wrong with me and that it was definitely my fault because I was so out of control with my eating. And that the light went on and all of a sudden it was like I entertained the idea that this was an addiction. And then take a step back. in my career, I'm a therapist, and for a while, I worked strictly with addiction and porn addiction with adolescent boys who were all addicted to pornography and they were sex offenders and stuff. And I was teaching the addiction, the cycle of addiction, and I never connected it to my own behavior, which is just bizarre. So I had to have it kind of through Dr. Tarman's book in my face. And then I got online on her Facebook, and through that I found Sweet Sobriety. And I was very grateful. I was able to get into the audit, one of the last audits they did. And I'm not someone who does groups real well in terms as a participant, because I've had some, I do as a leader. So it was really hard for me to like speak up in group, and you know, I was listening to people sharing and I was learning all this information, and it was like, it started to occur to me, okay, maybe this wasn't my fault. Maybe this is something in my brain, because if I keep going back further and further, and as I did the assignments in the foundations course and really looking at my history, it's like, we never had candy or anything sitting around out in my house. And I'd go to people's houses and it's like, they would have a bowl of candy there. Why can't we have that at my house? Oh, because I would eat the whole bowl. And my mother could never set anything like that out. And my mother was anorexic and she had a lot of body issues, which also influenced my relationship with food. So as I became more educated and more informed that maybe this was a brain thing, maybe this wasn't my fault, that I think was the most liberating first step of the recovery, because I had so much guilt and shame because I've lost 100 pounds like 3 times in my life now. And I've been on every diet there is, Nutrisystem, Weight Watchers, you know, the mushroom diet, the egg diet, the cauliflower, you know, it didn't matter if it came out. I was like, I'm going to try it. And because I always mixed it with exercise, a lot of aerobics, I've always been either doing aerobics or jazzercise or dancing of some kind, I was able to maintain the weight for a while, and then it would start coming back on. Because they never told you to stop eating sugar or carbs or processed food, that was the key. And that was the main shift. It was like, this is something different. Because I, you know, being this would be the third time I was trying to lose the 100 pounds again, because I put it back on during COVID, and because I didn't go to the gym and I didn't exercise and I just ate my way through the pandemic like a lot of folks did. But this time I kept hearing through Molly and Clarissa and the teachings through Sweet Sobriety that this is different. You know, once I got over the sugar cravings, it was like, wow, I really don't have sugar cravings at all.
I know, that's very freeing, isn't it? Like,
it's amazing.
It's funny to me, you know, because when people are getting started and they think it's always good, because I remember thinking this myself when I first started on my own journey, I was like, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to do this? This is so hard. But it doesn't stay like that. It doesn't stay hard. Right. In fact, it gets so much easier and it's more freeing, and it's that peace that you have that comes just so easily. And I wish I could bottle it and just give people a taste of it when they're in the beginning, because I want to assure them that it's not going to always be this difficult.
Right. Because the reaction I get from people when I tell them, they say, how did you do this? And I say, well, I haven't eaten any kind of sugar or flour or pasta or bread or processed food. They go, oh, I could never do that. That's too hard. Yeah, the first 2 weeks were hard. And I've got to admit that I had kind of a keto flu, and I wasn't following any set keto plan at that point. But my stomach was upset and I had a headache, and I learned that I could take probiotics and I could eat lots of yogurt, and I got through it. But for me, and this is something I learned through Sweet Sobriety, is the why had to be so strong. And for a lot of folks, it's not, you know, they just want to lose weight. And for me, it was, I want to live the rest of my life without heart attacks, without diabetes. I don't want to have to be getting insulin shots like my brothers. I don't want to have heart monitors and heart attacks and strokes that debilitated my one brother. That is not my future that I wanted to do. So what can I do to live better, healthier, and make sure the next 25 years of my life, you know, if I live to 100, are quality. So this is what I could do. So my why was really strong. And I had It is hard, but you have to go back to your why. And your why has to be so strong. Because I want to live. I don't want to be hooked to a machine. I don't want to die.
Well, you've touched on so many things right there. I got a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
What you said 2 years. So do you have a date? I mean, not that you, I don't know whether you count days or not, but for you.
I did not count days. It was when the Girl Scout cookie sale started. It was that week. So I know it's mid-February because they've been advertising and it's like, I just go, not my food. Now, I don't even miss it. I don't want it. And people say to me, don't you miss it? It's like, you know, I've eaten enough for a lifetime. And if I don't ever eat it again and I don't have diabetes, I'm good.
Yeah, I definitely can understand where you're coming from with that. The reason why I was asking you about that is because mine is 2 years as well. I did count days when I first started. I don't do that anymore, but it's 2 years March 7th. So by the time this episode comes out, we will just be past my 2 years. So that's awesome. We're so close together. That's awesome. Yeah. There's no candy bowls at my house either. But as you know, for my family, I have a sister in recovery and a brother that's in recovery. And my own personal story, my mother also didn't know she was she passed away before I found out about food addiction. So one of us would have eaten it all, or all of us would have eaten it together. So I certainly can relate to the candy bowl story too. Who has really been your biggest influence while you've been recovering? Like who are the people who influenced you the most especially when you first got started?
Well, I think Dr. Tarman and Clarissa and Molly, of course, and the warmth of the community that they have created. Because people, when they ask me, how did you do this? I always say, well, I didn't do it alone. I couldn't have done it alone. This is not something I could do by myself. And I needed that community and that support and that connection. I'm also an avid reader, and I just started reading books and, you know, like Breaking Up with Sugar and Metabolical and Hooked, and just got more and more into the whole, we are being manipulated by big food and being very angry about that. I'm not going to be manipulated by big food to buy their crummy products with, you know, high fructose corn syrup in it.
Yes, I totally agree. I liked Metabolical too. Have you read Christopher Van Tulliken's book, Ultra Processed People?
No, I've not. That's on my list.
Yeah, I highly recommend that one. I've recommended it so many times. That's one of my favorites. And that's actually, you know, he has all of the newer science that's come out, because it comes out so quickly now every time they find something new. Anyway, so thinking about your recovery as a whole, how would you define it? Like, what does recovery mean to you?
Recovery to me means keeping it in the front of my brain that I have to stay off these products if I want to stay healthy, and focusing on my why. If I let it go to the back of my brain and I become complacent with it. So it's an active process. It's a daily commitment. Some days it's waking up and just saying, and I have an accountability partner still, even 2 years in, that we will text each other in the morning and say, you know, I commit to eating on plan, abstinent foods and three meals a day. And I do a snack along with that because I'm a weightlifter, so I need a little bit more protein. But having that accountability and that daily accountability. So it's an active process. It's not a passive thing like, oh, I've got this, I'm done. It's not like that at all. It's something I have to be aware of every day and kind of daily recommit, because even though it's not hard for me anymore, in a lot of ways, I there's this little bit of fear in me. If I let go of this, I could relapse, because I've watched so many people in our community relapse, and I've not done that. I have not relapsed at all. So I always have this little fear of, you know, I could go down that slippery slope. So I've got to keep it in the front of my brain and really stay focused on it, even 2 years in.
All right. I like to keep it up right up in front. Like, I'm always scanning for potential problems, overcoming obstacles, which that is a great segue into my next question for you is, how did you overcome obstacles and setbacks, especially in the beginning when you were in recovery? Because I'm sure you've had setbacks regardless of whether you've returned to use.
Yes. Going out to dinner was very challenging, to the point where I stopped doing it for a while. It's like, I still weigh and measure stuff. And I still log my food, even 2 years in. And that helps me stay accountable. Even though I know what I'm eating and I kind of know the portions, I'm still guesstimating. So I feel better. And it's nothing for me to take out the measuring spoon and just measure a half cup. It's like, okay, half cup of yogurt, that keeps me honest, you know, half cup of berries. But I think in the beginning, going to people's houses, going to social events, going out to dinner, that was really hard. Probably the hardest was the first year of my birthday, because we celebrated it down in Mexico with friends. And we were at a very swanky restaurant, and they were pushing us to have cake for dessert. And I was going, I don't want cake. And everybody's going, oh, you have to have cake. It's your birthday. And I'm going, I don't want cake. So when they offered the different kinds of cakes, what they offered was a lemon cake. Well, I hate lemon cake. So I ordered a lemon cake. It's like, okay, if we're going to have a cake. So as they were all sitting around eating my birthday cake for my birthday, I felt very deprived and very angry. And I ended up leaving the restaurant, and my spouse was there. So I went down to the taxi and just waited for the taxi. It's like, I could not even sit at the table with these 10 people eating my cake. And I think it was more the emotional of the deprivation, of feeling deprived, feeling it wasn't fair. There was a whole lot of, and I think as you start realizing you're addicted to this stuff, you go through this period of, this isn't fair. Why me? Why can't I eat like normal people? And the bottom line is, I've never eaten like a normal person. And what's been cool for me is with my brothers, they are both food addicts as well. And we have talked about this at length, where if we would buy a pizza, and of course, pizza is one of the highest foods for addict people to binge out on, I would eat three pieces like a normal person, and then the rest would go in the fridge. And then like a few hours later, I'd be back and I'd eat the other five pieces. And, you know, my spouse would get up and go, where's the rest of the pizza? Oh, I ate it. Well, my brothers do the same thing. So, you know, I looked at the sugar in the sauce, you know, the sugar and the fat and the cheese, and of course the bread, and it's like, oh, this has got to go. This has got to go. So, and certain foods like that, having to give up, you know, when you're tired, and I still work part-time, and there are times I'm tired and I don't really feel like cooking. So we have to have like batch cook prepared for the week for real easy grab and goes. And that's kind of how I've learned how to deal with it. The deprivation part, I kind of got over that after a few months. And also the working through that, it's not fair. It's not fair that I can't eat like normal people, because I go out with friends and they eat bread and they eat all the stuff. And I sit there and I have to go, not my food, not my food, not my food. It's okay. I've eaten it all my life and it no longer serves my body in a healthy way. So I've had to change my mindset and the way I talked myself through this. And I think that's a big part of recovery, is changing the messages that you give yourself.
Oh, I so agree with that. One of the things that I have found too is that now that I'm a little bit further down the road than when I first started, is I actually feel sorry for people when I see them eating. You know, like we were at the mall the other day, I was with my daughter, and there was a very long line for Cinnabon. And I was looking at the people in line, I'm like, do they know that they're poisoning themselves? I mean, and if they knew that this is poison, would they still eat it? And so I just find myself just feeling really unhappy for people that I wish that they knew, you know, or is enlightened or has as many resources as we have available to us to find the information about how this food is killing us.
Well, and that's a big education piece that I wish more people would learn about, because like in Moore's book on Hooked, you know, he found about the food industry when he was researching Philip Morris and how they did the cigarette industry and lying to the people. And people got all outraged that they lied that, you know, cigarettes cause cancer. Well, if people read that book and had that information that sugar, you know, is also highly addictive like cigarettes, maybe they would think differently. But unfortunately, I think we're just at the beginnings of this process. It hasn't taken off in popular culture the way it needs to. And I guess we're at the forefront of being the ones who can make that happen. And hopefully we do. Because I know, and I kind of have, I have a lot of compassion for folks who are still stuck in it. And it's a hard decision to say, I'm going to eat clean, I'm going to eat healthy, I'm going to take care of myself. You really have to have a strong reason. And a lot of people just say, you know, this is what I eat. I love bread. I'm not giving it up. I'm not giving up pasta. I'm half Sicilian. I mean, we do pasta. I haven't done pasta in 2 years and it's okay.
Great. Well, thanks for sharing your insight on that. I think that'll be really helpful to some of our listeners. So I appreciate that. You kind of touched a little bit on some of the books that you thought were important for your recovery. Do you have some others that you might recommend to our listeners?
I really like Breaking Up with Sugar because it really dealt with the diet industry and kind of, she calls it divorcing the diet industry. And I think that was really a powerful concept for me because I was put on a diet when I was 16. I weighed 75 pounds less than I do right now. My mother put me on at 16. She put me on diet pills because she was 100 pounds and trophy wife and looked perfect, and I didn't. And I was still 5'7", and you know, I probably weighed about 150 pounds. And so I was on these diet pills and lost a bunch of weight. And the first time I got down to like what would be a size 0 now, it was like a size 5. I was like 105 pounds. And that was the only time my mother ever said she was proud of how I looked. Yeah. So that was the value in my house about how you should look. So it was very important for me to be able to look at, there's a whole diet culture out there that supports how women are supposed to look. And it's a lie. And it disregards body types, genetics. You know, there are just so many elements that go into how you look. Even if I'm thin, I'm still going to look like a big person. My frame is big. You know, that's how I'm built. I would never look like my mom did. And I was adopted, but she was trying to fit me into a mold of what looked appropriate. And then I think there was some rebellion on my part too. I started gaining weight. It was like kind of, I'm not looking like you do. I mean, my mom You know, she wore like skinny jeans and Candy's high-heeled shoes and had, you know, just, she was a trophy wife. And even my grandmother gave me messages that, you know, no man's going to want you if you're overweight. And it's like, how about no man would want me if I don't have a college education and a career? But that was a different time. But that's all part of the diet culture. And you look at our models and like Twiggy was the standard when I was growing up. That's horrible. So
that's for sure. I was raised in the South. In the South. And so it was very important for women to look a certain way. So I got those messages as well. And it's interesting to me, one of my best friends is actually the dean of the department for the university, where she's my best friend. And we were raised so differently. And, I say, you know, we all get to where we're going. We just have different ways of traveling there. So all of that went in to make the person that I am today. So we're just going to move on with what we've learned and hopefully not give the next generation those same messages.
Right. That's my thing. And I had that chance with my daughter.
Exactly. That's great.
Yeah.
So have you, is there any significant lessons or insight that you've thought of when you're in your recovery process that you wish you'd have known earlier? Like, is there something that really sticks out? Gosh, I wish I'd have figured this out sooner in my journey.
Yes. And I think, again, it goes back to trying to be the good person and the kind person and the nice person and all that, and not being willing to say no and stick up for myself. And I remember the first time we had dinner out with our best friends after I stopped eating sugar, and they're from Germany, and culturally you don't say no to their desserts. And it was very hard for me to say no. I just ended up saying, I'm stuffed. I can't eat anymore. But as I talked more and more to them, I got more comfortable with standing up for myself and saying, no, I'm sorry, I don't eat that. And especially in restaurants where they immediately put down bread or appetizers that are full of stuff. And no, I don't want bread at the table. Thank you. You know, and learn. I wish that I had figured out earlier that it was okay for me to say no and take care of myself, because I had been somewhat of a people pleaser. I'm a healthcare worker. That's what I do. So it was hard at first to set boundaries, because it was like, who doesn't eat that stuff? They kind of look at you funny. And, or, you know, we went somewhere to another friend's house, and I ate her enchiladas, and I went, oh, these are really sweet. And she said, yeah, everybody makes them with sugar. You add a cup of sugar to the sauce. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I politely finished the one enchilada, but when she tried to give us some to take home, I was like, no, that's okay. Thank you. So those kinds of things, those are hard. Those are the social things I think that are the hardest in recovery, because people look at you funny. People think you're kind of like weird at first. And then you always feel like you have to justify, you know, like I would say, well, I don't want to be diabetic. Or then I start saying, well, I am diabetic, because that was a way of like setting limits. And now I've learned to just say, no, thank you. So that's been a progression. And I wished, and maybe you have to go through that to get to the point where you can say just no, thank you. You know, it's not my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's a progression, just becoming more comfortable in your own skin. And I think in the beginning, or at least for myself, I should say, I just didn't want to stick out. I just didn't want to be noticed. I just wanted to blend in. So, but now, and the other thing too that I see happen as well is, especially if you've been doing this for as long as we have, many people know that this is our life, you know, and they've learned to accept it. And so they don't expect you to partake in whatever that is or whatever. One of the things that I don't like to eat late. I would prefer not to. If I was at a dinner with my husband, it was a business dinner, I would eat late, because I it's for him. The event is about him. It's not about me. But if I'm going out with friends and they want to eat late, I'll eat earlier in the day and I'll just sit there and enjoy their company. And I've been able to do that now that I've been doing this for so long. So you kind of develop these strategies as you go along.
Absolutely. So I think kind of. And for me, eating late, if I wait until like 8 o'clock to eat, I'm too hungry and that could set off binge behavior. So for me, I always have that little thing going, ding, ding, ding. You need to eat something around 4 o'clock if you're going to eat at 7 or 8 so that at least you're not going into a situation starving. And what the other thing I've learned is we went to the theater. I guess I was like 6 months into this. And it was a celebration with cheesecakes and all this. And I brought string cheese and hard-boiled eggs in my purse. And again, I'm like, yeah, I didn't want to stand out, but I also didn't want to compromise my sobriety. So it's like everybody's eating cheesecake. So I took out some string cheese and sliced up my little egg and people are looking at me and it's like, it's cool.
Well, the other thing, I mean, if people have, lots of people have dietary needs. I don't know why I thought I was any different than anybody else who had special dietary needs. You know, if I had to eat a certain way for whatever it is, you know, I don't stand out any more than anybody else who has particular dietary needs. And I would honor any of my friends who had dietary restrictions. I have a daughter who has a lot of sensitivities and there's so many things that she cannot eat and people just adjust, you know.
My friends have been awesome. We have several groups of friends and they now, you know, they make sure that they have like berries because I don't eat a lot of fruit, but I eat berries or they'll have like almond crack or they'll have cheese or something like that, that, you know, nuts that, you know I can eat. And they will ask me, they say, you know, is it okay with you if I prepare this? And at first that was very hard for me. It was like, you don't have to do anything special for me. You just do that and I'll take care of it and I'll do me. But I appreciate now that people they're becoming more aware because they see the changes in me and not just physically.
You're a beacon of light. Yes, I love it. So that's actually a perfect way for me to get to the next question, which is, what is the day in the life of recovery? What does an average day look like for you?
Well, I have to eat 3 meals a day, and I have to eat. I have to have 140 grams of protein because I lift weights 3 to 4 times a week, and that's a lot of protein. So I have to get up and I make up usually 3 or 4 eggs with cheese in it and go to work for a while. And then I go work out for a while. And when I get done working out, I always make sure that I have more protein. And usually I have about 4 or 5 ounces of protein in a salad so that I have lots of good fiber. And I kind of have this balance going of I work for a few hours, I go to the gym and work out for a few hours, then I come back home and work for a few more hours. So I make sure I stagger my meals so that I get protein. And then for dinner, it's always something like fish. We don't eat a lot of red meat, again, because of the heart stuff, but we'll have like fish and chicken. And where what we've done is we'll have a salad and 2 vegetables. We've replaced the grains with a second vegetable.
What other things besides your food do you do for recovery on a daily basis?
Well, I have my accountability partner. So we chat in, we set our intentions for the morning to stay abstinent, to eat on plan, and to eat on schedule. Because eating on schedule is really important to my recovery. And I know it's not an issue for all people in recovery, but I know for me, if I get too hungry, that's going to set me up to overeat or volume eat. So I have to really think about and plan my meals ahead of time and think about when I'm going to do things, especially with balancing it between work and working out. It's kind of a little bit of a juggling thing. I try to go to meetings. the community meetings have been fantastic. And I check on the WhatsApp and try to support other people and chime in where I can. Sometimes the meetings are hard for me to get to because of my work schedule. But the meetings have been so helpful, and I've learned to share and be more open because I am kind of a private person. So being vulnerable and being open has been a big step for me. The community is essential. The community support, the community connections. That is such a big part of my recovery. And even if I'm not on the group talking to people as a group, I'm probably talking to someone individually because I've got some connections with other folks who are doing this. And I read books. I read books all the time. If I'm not working or working out, and sometimes I listen to the Food Junkies podcast when I am working, if I'm on the treadmill, or now I'm listening to your podcast. There's a couple other podcasts I like that are, I tend to listen to Dr. Westman's because I kind of followed the keto program for a long time. And that's what helped me shed a lot of the weight. And I also listened to Peter Attia, who I'm reading his book, Outlive. So I've been reading that and kind of listening to that. So I guess I'm kind of inundating my brain through reading, listening, making sure I'm getting food on the schedule I need and healthy foods.
All right. Well, you've given a lot of good suggestions. I'm sure that the audience appreciates that. I know I do. I actually just wrote down, I haven't read Peter Attia's book yet, Outlive, but I just made a note for it. So I'll put that on my list.
It's a good read.
Oh, good, good. I like to read too. I listen to a lot of Audible books. I tend to read for like novels, like when I'm trying to get ready for bed and stuff like that. That was something that I adopted in my recovery, was that to read before I went to bed to just let my brain get a little bit more quiet. So that was one of the things that I put to, still haven't worked on. I'm still not doing great with meditation. I listen to a guided meditation before I go to sleep, or like I'm on my way to sleep. And sometimes I'll use that meditation during the day if I've gotten too anxious about something. But I will say it's not one of my favorite tools, but I'll get there eventually.
Well, meditation comes in many forms, and that was something they addressed in Foundations. And I really got in touch with, because I dance, and dance and movement is a form of meditation. And it's a time when I really get out of my head into my body and really feel my body. The same with weightlifting. So doing things that help me kind of live in my body and not from the neck up. I mean, those are forms of meditation too, or just swirling around or shaking it out if you're anxious. For me, I'm a little bit of a hyper energy kind of person. So sitting still for a meditation thing doesn't quite work for me. And I'm okay with that because the moving meditation, that's where I have found my meditation. That's where I found kind of my center.
Right. That's a good point. I actually am. I'm a road cyclist, so I'll ride on the roads. And when I'm in the Peloton, there'll be about 10 or 12 of us in the Peloton. And just the sounds of the bike and the wheels and stuff like that and the swishing, it's very methodical. I enjoy that sound very much. And I guess it's a form of meditation. I never thought about that.
It is. Meditation comes in many, many forms, and that's one of them, you know, definitely.
Thank you. What's something that you're still working on currently in recovery? What's something you're still working on?
I still have this little fear back there that I'm going to blow it, that I'm going to lose it, that I'm going to go back to where I was. I am so much happier in my body and more content with who I am and feel good about me. But there's always this fear of I'm going to fail because I've done this before. But when I've worked with Molly individually, and she reassures me that I haven't done it this way. that my brain will respond differently because I'm not eating the trigger foods that put me back there. So it's trusting myself. I'm trusting Molly right now. I'm not trusting me. But I still have that inkling of doubt. And maybe that's kind of helps motivate me to stay away from relapse. But it also, I know that it gets in the way of totally being at peace. And that's what I, you know, when I started this journey, I had this little sticky on my computer and it said, what do you want? I want to be at peace in my body. I want to feel at peace with food because I always felt like I had this war going on inside my head with food. Because I would do all this stuff and then I would feel so badly about it. And I don't do those things anymore. And I do feel at peace with food. I do feel much more at peace in my body. And I mean, it's this experience with sweet sobriety is a lot of it in the community and the people and the whole process of getting there.
That's awesome. Yeah, the peace. That's definitely something that I would like to bottle. Boy, we could make lots of money if we can bottle that, right, Joan?
Exactly. Exactly. Unfortunately, it's not bottled. You have to work for it.
You have to work really hard. Yes. What does life look like after recovery? Now that you have been in recovery for a while, what does life look like now?
It's so much easier to watch TV and see all these commercials for food and cakes and things in my face. And it doesn't even faze me, where before it was a little bit challenging. I don't even think about eating things that are not part of my plan, part of my abstinent foods, because this is the way I eat. This is just the way I don't even think about it anymore. It's nothing I struggle with. It's like, I just accept this is the way I eat. This is the way I'm going to eat. And if I want to live healthy, this is the way I'm going to have to eat. So just kind of being a whole lot of acceptance about it. So a lot of that struggle is over. And I think having that sense of peace about, I don't have the war inside my head about food is, you know, been the best part of this whole thing. That and my blood work looks great, and my lipids and my, you know, all that stuff and cholesterol. So, you know, I'm so much healthier. And I did go to the doctor recently. He said, you are not the average 70-year-old woman that I see. You know, but because of everything just looked really good. And I said, it's because of the way I eat and exercise. And he said, absolutely.
That's awesome. What kind of, do you have any challenges personally that you're not in the realm of food, but new challenges that you're taking on or anything exciting coming up for you now that you're been in recovery for a while?
We just got a new puppy yesterday, and that's kind of stressful. We're trying to keep her from messing on the floor. So we didn't sleep very well last night. That creates stress. I need to stay focused on managing my stress because that's the one area that I'm not real great at. I use exercise to relieve stress, and I had a minor surgical thing last week, and I've not been able to exercise. It's now going on a week and a half. And as someone who exercises, you know, if you don't do it for a couple of days, your body starts getting kind of like, ooh, you need to go, you need to do. So finding ways to do like a lot of deep breathing, a lot of self-talk, a lot of keeping busy, a lot of doing little projects that to basically broaden my coping skills to it's not just exercise.
That's awesome. That's great. All right, we're winding down here and I'm going to ask you our signature question. If your body or spirit could speak, what would it say about the changes you have made on your journey?
Thank you. Thank you for loving me enough to do this.
That's awesome. Well, Joan, I really appreciate you being here with us today, and I look forward to hearing more from you as we will be recovery buddies for a long time. So thank you again.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining me this week for Food Junkies Recovery Stories. Make sure you join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group. I'm Sweet Enough. Please subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in today's story, we would appreciate a ratings on iTunes. If you've been inspired by today's show and would like to be a guest, please reach out through the email provided in the show notes. If you have additional questions, CJ is a food addictions professional and works one-on-one with clients. You can find her email address and website in the show notes. Thank you for joining us.